There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello, welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. This is our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show, today being Wednesday, November the 13th. There are calls to double maternity leave across the UAE, and that's divided our studio somewhat today.
Sheikha Badour bin Sultan Al Qasimi has called for extended maternity leave from the private sector. And we've been chatting about this morning to lawyers and to HR experts and to listeners, because we have had absolutely no shortage of people coming in talking about maternity, paternity, and how it all fits together. Let's look at the law first, because we've been hearing from Rebecca Kelly.
Yeah, she's an employment lawyer. She's with Morgan Lewis. And we wanted to know, what are UAE companies supposed to be doing? So what's the kind of minimum? But then what are companies actually doing in practice?
The UAE law sets the minimum standard by which every company must comply when calculating paternity and maternity leave entitlements for their employees. However, what we see in practice is that more and more companies will introduce enhanced leave entitlements in order to guarantee that their talent remains engaged and is able to return to work after maternity or paternity leave. However, if an employee is working within one of the two financial free zones, the Abu Dhabi Global Market or the Dubai International Financial Centre, both of those financial free zones have their own employment regulations and they have enhanced their maternity and paternity leave entitlements in the past year. And unlike the UAE federal regime, maternity leave under both the DIFC and the ADGM provides that employees are entitled to a minimum of 65 working days, as opposed to 45 calendar days, which is provided for onshore.
Well, one company that does go above and beyond the basics of the law is Edelman. It's an American company based in Chicago, the world's biggest public relations company. And here in the Middle East, they give a relatively generous allowance, not just to mothers, but also to fathers and to parents who are adopting children. Kim Trong, head of HR, explains.
We are a family-run business, and as such, all of our policies and processes like to reflect that. And as a progressive company, we actually offer 3 months of full-paid maternity leave, as well as 3 months of unpaid maternity leave. After that, the employee can choose to take an additional 1 month unpaid or 1 month working from home.
So we ask him, that's all very nice, but you are running a business. How much does it cost you?
Well, at the moment, we have around 14 working mums. We have 3 women at the moment on maternity leave. So, yes, it does cost us. But actually, in terms of the return, women coming back from maternity leave and retaining strong talent within the business, it's a cost that you just can't measure.
Fathers get 10 days paternity leave. UAE law stipulates no paternity leave whatsoever. And they also extend this to parents who are adopting children.
The adoption policy is exactly the same as maternity, and that's been in place now for over 5 years.
And I think one of the key things about this is that, you know, in the UAE, you tend to pay people for leave. In the US, the regulation says maternity leave 12 weeks, but it's unpaid, largely.
I think actually UAE law gives 3 days of paternity leave, doesn't it?
Nope. I had a look on government.ae earlier to clarify.
Okay.
And it says there is no paternity leave.
Well, look, we have had no shortage of messages from people. And funnily enough, paternity leave, I would say, has got about 50% of the messages, which surprised me. But then we've heard some really logical arguments about it. Lindsay's been in touch, says there should definitely be more focus on paternity leave.
I think the UAE is still early days, and it's great to hear that we're considering reviewing or extending some of the maternity and parental leave in general. I would say it's absolutely key that you extend paternity leave as well as maternity leave if you're aiming to attract, retain and develop women in the workplace, which I know is on everyone's agenda.
And funnily enough, we've had a couple of people getting in touch making the argument that if you extend paternity leave, then you actually take away some of the discrimination against women, which might sound counterintuitive. But if you have people like, was it Alan Sugar who said earlier he wouldn't basically hire anyone with a working womb?
Well, you're putting words in his mouth. Alan Sugar is a British billionaire, created the Amstrad Computer Company, and he presents The Apprentice in the United Kingdom. So he's a bit of a kind of Donald Trump type figure. And what he said a while ago was this. He says, I think twice about hiring a woman in her late 20s or early 30s, particularly if she's recently married, because I know that in the UK, women are entitled to up to a year for each child. So if I've got someone, he said, if he's in their late 20s and they're planning to embark on having three children, let's say that's going to be 5 years or so, he says essentially that's a very senior person who I'm only going to see from time to time over the next 5 years. He says, I can't afford to do that. And the other thing he said was, I'm saying this out loud because I'm Sir Alan Sugar and I can get away with it. He said, I know privately lots of people think like this. They would never admit it in public, but privately, when they're making those decisions and it's two equal candidates for a senior position and one of them's a recently married woman, age 31, and one of them's a 31-year-old bloke, they'll go for the bloke for that reason.
Well, you can probably imagine what I think of those comments, but we've had a number of people who have messaged in to say paternity actually helps with this kind of discrimination, because if you offer a huge whacking amount of paternity leave, then it stops childbearing women or women of childbearing age being, to people like Sir Alan Sugar, risky hires, because effectively men could just be as risky hires. So you are, in a weird way, kind of leveling that playing field. It's an argument I hadn't thought of before, and someone was saying, if you look at Scandinavia, certain countries, it's certainly something that's played out there.
Leveling the playing field, there's an idea, Brandy Scott.
Isn't it? Someone should put together a brilliant series of seminars on exactly this topic. We've also heard from Ahsan, who says that he's happy with what's offered in the UAE in terms of maternity laws, but he is concerned about laws in other countries, which he says could cost businesses.
In UAE, I actually think it's quite reasonable. It varies between 90 working days up to 6 months, depending on the employer. But places like UK, for example, if employers have to give up to 1 year, that's extremely costly for the business.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking loyalty programs, and one company that's upping their game in the loyalty program wars is Emirates Airline Group. They've launched something new for their Skywards programs called Skywards Exclusives. And joining us on the line to explain how it works and why they're doing it is Dr. Najib Bin Kader. He's the Senior Vice President for Skywards Emirates. So Skywards Exclusives allows members of your loyalty program to bid to use their miles for exclusive sporting events in particular, but also cultural events. Explain briefly how it works, but more importantly, why you're doing this.
Yes, Richard, thanks for the opportunity. So Skywards Exclusive is actually a platform where our 25 plus million members can use their Skywards miles to redeem or bid for curated experiences from the Emirates large sponsorship portfolio. That includes, as you mentioned, world-class sporting events, performances, concerts, VIP hospitality, and of course, thrilling money can't buy experiences globally. In terms of the rationale behind this, our vision has been to build one of the most engaging global lifestyle loyalty program. And there is no better way, of course, to create stickiness then through unforgettable experiences. And we have rich assets, as you know, in terms of sponsorships. And beyond the Fly Better flight and travel experience, as a loyalty program, we wanted to further leverage these assets to create the emotional link with our members.
So it's great that I can now, as a Skywards member, potentially get tickets to watch a Real Madrid football match or even hospitality at the air show next year. But there's a cost involved in this to Emirates. How do you balance the need to make your program as attractive or more attractive than all the other airline programs out there and the benefits?
As I mentioned, Richard, we have these sponsorship assets. Now, there's a cost, obviously, in terms of sponsorships, and of course, sponsorships are there also to promote the brand globally. So, of course, there is a cost, but most importantly for us, we wanted to find a way to reward our members with unforgettable experiences. And again, for us, people can choose of course, their to use their miles for upgrades or for reward tickets, which, by the way, continues to be really the most attractive part of the program, where 84% of the miles are used in that category. But we wanted to expand again and provide these experiences for our members, for them to again find a use for their miles. We talk about fly better and travel better. I would just say for leave better as well, and leave these exceptional moments.
Physically, how does that work? Do people book with their miles and you go out and buy the tickets, or do you have a pool of tickets?
So it depends. So we've got some of the general admission tickets. We have an inventory of tickets. As a matter of fact, so far since we've launched this and communicated about a month ago, we have a week ago we started communicating, but we soft launched it about a month ago. We have about 3,000 tickets across a number of events, 208 events that are available. And then most of these are, again, general admission, but there are really VIP experiences that are put for bid. And people can just do this either on the website, or they can do it, which is a very easy and engaging experience, on the mobile app.
Dr. Najib, we've been talking this morning about unused cash on cards, points that expire, not just in Skywards program, but across and around the world. Yeah. How many out of you've got 25 million members, how many Skywards miles expire each year?
So I'll talk about the UAE specifically for our audience here. We have about 12% of the miles expire each year for our UAE members. We have 1.7 million members here. A lot of them are very, very active on the program. And there are different ways for us to look at activity. One of it is flight active. And about 40% of our members are actually flight active. And then program active is a much higher number. I believe Dave Battiston earlier in the show talked about some numbers there around Skywards, and we're in that vicinity.
So 12% of all the miles earned in the UAE expire every year,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
a similar, I mean, London is your biggest or your membership yeah. base. Is that a similar yeah. percentage in London?
A bit higher, I would say, in our other bases than the UAE, where we have a very, very engaged, again, for a good reason, a very engaged set of members. But still, we're with things like Skywards Exclusive, we're trying to offer more opportunity. I have to tell you something about the UAE key, as you expect, and Arsenal is very popular, and the redemptions for Arsenal. So since we launched this, one third of the miles that have been used for these events actually came from the UK. So far, 3.9 million members miles have been used by UK members for the mostly for the Arsenal games.
Is this you're giving me percentages here? I was just trying to find out how many miles, absolute miles, expire globally. Is that a figure you either don't know or you just don't want to tell me?
No, I mean I can share in general. I don't think this is I think important for our audience.
We have
every year we have 50 billion miles or so being redeemed, and then a bit more than 60 billion that are being earned.
Okay, so, if that's how many redeem, we can kind of get a feeling of how many would expire as well. So yeah. I want to know really is obviously why those can't be used for good. Why can they not be put to charity? Why do they just expire and disappear?
We would love for people to use them for charity, and it's a good point you're bringing, Malcolm. You can donate miles, and we made it extremely easy for the Emirates Foundation in particular, and you made it extremely easy through the app as well. If you go into the spend category in the app under the Skywards section, you will find it extremely easy to donate your miles as well, and I think we're coming into the holiday seasons. We have a peak during Ramadan period as well, where we have people donating the miles.
I guess
very good use of the miles as well.
I think if people donate, that's one thing, but there's obviously a lot more that just expire than get donated. Could you not give those to charity as well?
We could look into it, but this is part of the economics of the program that we look at and try to fine-tune. Once again, we do a lot in terms of, first of all, offering other opportunities for people to earn miles, as you know, in their everyday spend, but also, through flying. 75% of the miles earned are through flying. But in terms of spend, again, we're introducing things like exclusive here, where you can bid your miles. You can donate your miles. Of course, we have more and more reward tickets. We had, in terms of flight-related rewards, we had more than 1 million activities around flight-related rewards, either reward tickets or upgrades or using your miles for cash plus miles. So plenty of opportunities to use your miles. And we want really our members to be active in that way as well.
Dr. Najib, I know it's a tough one to talk about. Thank you very much indeed for your frankness on this. Dr. Najib Benkadar, Senior VP, Skywards Emirates. Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We're talking about loyalty schemes.
Call me loyal. I'll say loyal.
That's because a lot of statistics we've been looking at this morning suggest that an awful lot of money, $100 billion in the US and Canada alone, is being left unclaimed in loyalty schemes from shops, from airlines, from service providers. We've been speaking to the people who put together loyalty schemes here in the UAE to find out what we are seeing. One of those we've spoken to is Manav Fernandez, who is a co-founder at Quick Brown Fox Consulting. And one of the things that they do is they come up with loyalty schemes. We're going to hear from him in a moment about what he thinks makes an effective loyalty program. But before we do, let's actually hear what he has to say as one potential solution. If you're not spending your points, he says, there is a way that they can still do some good.
So there's a platform in the UK called For Good Causes. It's forgoodcauses.org. And it's based around the basic principle that there's about £7 billion worth of unused points in the UK and $100 billion worth of points in the US. So based on this, they've basically now signed up. I think they have over 14,000 charities in the UK signed up to the platform that people can donate their points towards. And that's one way to use up your unused points.
If, however, you're like the rest of us and you don't even know where the cards are, stuff's at the bottom of old wallets, at the bottom of drawers, you are not alone. So we've had Manav in the studio to explain what it actually says about loyalty programs in general. And he began by answering Malcolm's question about what, in his opinion, actually makes an effective loyalty program. This is Manav Fernandez.
I think at the heart of any good program is to be customer-centric. So you really need to understand what your customer values before you start thinking about giving them something back. Additionally, I would say things like transparency. So, you know, let the customer understand exactly what they're earning and what the value is of those points they're earning. And generosity, you know, don't give them things that they don't value, and don't necessarily be too business centric in your giving away of points or rewards, because if they can't use them, then you end up with a huge bank of points that are basically unused.
I mean, I get points that expire from a lot of different companies, and quite often it's because I haven't spent enough with them to earn enough points to actually get anything back, and partly it's laziness. But these prepaid cards are quite something. I mean, £400 million is a lot of money, and that's money that people have actually put onto a card. It's money they've spent, and technology is sort of leaving people behind, really, as smartphones take over. But I'm struggling to get my head around this £400 million thing. Why would people leave that much money on a card?
I think it's, well, I'm one of those people. I have an Oyster card.
with money on it,
yeah. Which I bought in London, I think, last year. And then subsequently, my brother, who lives in London, has decided to buy us a card. And he has a couple of cards that he keeps for when I travel back, because obviously I forget the card that I have. Now, those are all, you know, cards with maybe £5, £8, £9 that you kind of forget, and that adds up, isn't it? So I think that the trick is not so much in terms of educating people, but giving them options on what to do with that excess.
Well, what is the relationship between spend and reward? Is there a formula?
I think different industries have a different relationship, and that's an ever-evolving relationship. The reality is that relationship is based purely on your P&L. What are you willing to give away, and what is the objective of your business?
I mean, how do companies like yours or the program owner measure the success of a program? I mean, if I was Transport for London, I would think, hey, we've failed. If people are not using our services but paying us money, that means that maybe the engagement isn't there. They haven't bothered spending the money. On the other hand, you look at it perhaps as an accounting win, £400 million on your books. But how do you judge the success of a program?
So these leftover points in the business are called breakage. And breakage used to be, like you mentioned, an accounting win. But it also shows a tremendous lack of engagement. Now, when it comes to transport, obviously people are using their cars, they're using the transport. So I think the win is, or rather the change is in technology. So you've got to move away from a card to a technology that's in your hand all the time, which is a mobile phone.
Yep.
And then figure out if people are left with points, like tourists, etc., give them options in terms of what they can do with them. Breakage is now becoming a negative sort of measure of in a business.
Rather than a financial win.
Exactly. And people, when you break points, there's actually a negativity associated with that. So a program that I have suddenly reminds me that if I don't use my points, I lose them. That actually creates a negative association with the program. So more and more programs are finding that they're not breaking points at all. So your points are endless. And a good example locally would be Emirates NBD, whose plus points don't break. You have them for life.
Yeah, by breaking, that's industry talk for expiring, obviously. No one's coming around and chopping your card in half. Manez Fernandez is a co-founder at Quick Brown Fox Consulting. We've had another expert in as well, actually. I've been speaking to Dave Battiston, who's a partner at the Texa Group. He has been in the loyalty points business for decades. I think at one stage he was the CEO, or certainly very high up, if not the actual CEO, of Air Miles, you know, the ones you get when you're in the supermarket, the blue and yellow. He was chatting to us about what you need to do to get it right, to set up a scheme so that people actually do go and use all their points. And we asked him whether or not there was a ratio or some kind of magic equation of spend to reward that gives a scheme and their points enough value to be valuable.
Every market you're working in, you've got to look at what's currently out there in the marketplace, what your competitors are doing. If you look at the UK, you know, I don't know if you know the Boots card, they give a 4% value back equation to the customer. That works really well, you know, and then they double that out and they do redemptions. Some multi-partner programs give, you know, 50 basis points, so 0.5% to 1%, but that can work well because you're doing your grocery shopping, you're doing credit card, you're doing insurance and many other things. And when you look at the frequent flyer programs, they're roughly at 1.25%, 1.25% back to you on your credit card spend, which a lot of the value comes back to you. You're getting those points like Skywards, and you're obviously going to redeem more and upgrade more and do things like that.
The thing that's surprising me, Dave, on this is the loyalty cards are one thing, and you know, we don't always use our loyalty points, but prepaid cards, Transport for London saying they've got £400 million of unused credit. Is this common on prepaid cards, that people actually just don't bother taking the money out of it or off the cards?
Yeah, I think on prepaid cards, customers should know the value. The big thing with what they need to be doing is communicating well. We see one thing is to have a good customer value proposition, and the other is to making sure you've got the right people, processes and tools so you can communicate to customers. And especially with prepaid, you know, the customers should know they've got the value on it. It's, you know, especially with WhatsApp, texting and everything as well. And it's real cash to customers. So I'm actually surprised that figure's so high. And maybe it's a communication thing, what they're trying to do.
It is a massive figure, isn't it? I mean, does that suggest to you that the customer loyalty proposition for Transport for London has failed, effectively?
I think, you know, Oyster's a fantastic program, you know, for getting around and using the transport system. There's Octopus program here. I'm in Hong Kong at the moment, so that's a fantastic program right across all the transport. Sometimes they get it wrong when they're giving loyalty back as well, and they're giving a little bit of value, but they're not using their partnership relationships well. You know, that's just one of those things there. But telco loyalty programs are doing really well. You know, Vodafone do Vodafone Stars. They do it for their top base. You know, they give 1-3% back to customers. And, you know, those programs work well in the telco sector. So maybe it's a communication thing.
And that is Dave Battiston, who is a partner at the Taxa Group, speaking to us about loyalty points.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
And my newsmaker is a very large mouse.
When you wish upon a star, make no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you.
And that is because we have seen the new streaming service, the new player in this increasingly competitive landscape, go live with a few glitches.
Yes, Disney are kind of, they're trying to spin the glitches as a problem of success, in that it's so popular we couldn't cope with the overwhelming demand for our fabulous new service. Are we buying that
now? No. Do you know what? I had a moment. Disney Plus, by the way, is what launched yesterday. For Americans, it's going to be $7 a month. It's obviously the biggest hit to Netflix so far. They had a number of technical errors at the launch. People were just finding that they couldn't get on and see the stuff that they wanted to see. A lot of people were met with error messages on launch day. Disney's kind of like, well, you know, the consumer demand for Disney Plus exceeded our expectations. We are pleased with this incredible response, and we are working to quickly resolve the current user issue. Do you know what it just reminded me of? It reminded me of 1999, when all of a sudden everyone decided they needed a portal because there was the internet. And I don't know how many ballrooms I sat in watching people launch their portals, their platforms. I mean, this is pre-internet shopping, their whateverness. And there would always be some kind of giant screen that had been pulled down for the occasion. The lunch would be good. You'd be somewhere like the Emirates Towers. And you would have the CEO or some luminary being wheeled out to make the first, you know, log on, sign up, whatever it happened to be, for what was being launched in the early sort of excitement of the internet. And I would estimate that a third of the time you'd get a spinning wheel of doom for a good minute before it would go through. And your heart would just go out to the guy. You'd be like, oh, no. And to the point that you'd start thinking, you know, because they're on the hotel's connection, obviously, and you just think of all the times for this. And it would usually go through, but it might just take a bit longer. And you think, why would you put yourself under that pressure?
Yeah,
I know. When I think of 1999, I think of two things. I think of the Prince song, Party Like It's 1999, and also Y2K. Do you remember how sweaty and nervous we were about Y2K?
I do.
Throughout 1999? Are we going to be ready?
I had a workmate who was stocking up on Omani ceremonial swords.
In case there was a sudden shortage.
Because he wasn't quite sure what was going to happen with it. Yeah. Swords turned out to be unnecessary. I've learnt a couple of things from the Disney Plus launch that I didn't know. Number one, I finally worked out what the big deal is. Because I have to admit, I've kind of been in the camp of, okay, Disney Plus is launching. It's the Netflix killer. Is it? I mean, I'm not sitting down and watching Disney movies, I don't think.
Well, they've got 500 movies, 7,500 TV episodes, so it's not just movies.
It includes all the Marvel stuff. It includes all the Pixar stuff. It includes the Disney stuff, Star Wars, National Geographic, and 20th Century Fox. So it's a much bigger stable than I realised. The other thing that I kind of hadn't realised, and it's so basic, but the moment I read it, I thought that makes perfect sense, was a note from Morgan Stanley saying one of Disney's big advantages is they don't need to spend as much marketing. And they don't need to spend as much acquiring customers and building a brand and all the rest of it as Netflix, because effectively I've been doing it for decades.
Yeah, and they've got original content, and I get that, but I'm looking at their original content. It doesn't look particularly compelling. They've got a couple of spin-offs, one from Marvel, some young superheroes. They've got a spin-off from Toy Story 4 about a talking fork. They've got another Christmas movie, which has got a 50% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
But is it for you or is it for your kids? This is, I mean, you know, it's not expensive. $7 a month in the States. That's not expensive. 25 dirhams?
They're hoping, I think, that there'll be a lot of nostalgia play for this, that people will want to watch older movies that they grew up with, whatever it happens to be.
Fantasia.
They want their kids to watch the kids' movies that they watched, and that's where a lot of the demand will come from.
But enter stage left, Stars Play, which is one of the local streaming services, and it's kind of neck and neck with Netflix in the Middle East in terms of subscriber numbers. I watched Return of the Jedi last weekend with my youngest son. on Stars Play, and it's still there.
And it will continue to still be there, because we have been speaking recently to the CEO of Stars Play, Maz Sheikh, who has said that they're not getting their content, Disney content, ripped off them in the way that other players are. He also kind of let it slip that the big American content providers like HBO and Disney aren't going to be launching directly here anytime soon. This is Maz.
You know, I think in the what we see for the next 3 to 4 years at least is that Warner's service, so the studio behind HBO is Warner. You also mentioned Disney and Disney Plus. With both these studios, Stars Play has long-term multi-year partnerships and content deals. So which is a signal to the market that this is not one of the markets they'll enter anytime soon. They're leaving their content and shows on Stars Play for years to come.
Maz Sheikh of Stars Play Disney Plus has launched, but not yet in this region. My newsmaker today is a news person, Rula Khalaf, the Lebanese journalist, who is the new editor of the Financial Times, the first woman to lead the newspaper in its more than 100-year history. And, of course, the first Arab to edit the newspaper. She's been deputy editor for a while, but now
24
she's
years.
Got the chop. She was my boss.
Well, she's been with the FT for 24 years.
She was my boss when I worked for the FT.
Really?
In fact, in the early days of doing the Business Breakfast, my day job was freelance correspondent for the FT out here. She's an incredible woman, but she rose from being Middle East editor, then she was deputy editor, and now from a very, very competitive field, she's got the top job. This is her speaking last year at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
The mood here in Davos this year is a lot more positive. If we compare it to last year, when being a liberal and being a globalist brought a lot of anxiety, I think this year people are feeling a lot more calm, and satisfied, content that the global economy is recovering, markets are soaring, and that possibly the worst of what they had expected did not come to pass.
So that is her talking about the economy, which she does well. She was in a movie quite recently, or rather she was portrayed in a movie quite recently.
Really?
Do you know which one?
No.
I didn't until this morning and I read about it. The Wolf of Wall Street.
Ha! Huh.
The Jordan Belfort movie, because Rula's first job when she after Columbia Journalism School back in the day was working for Forbes magazine, and she did a lot of investigative reporting about Jordan Belfort and his bogus hooky stock brokerage firm. And this is what he wrote about her in The Wolf of Wall Street. The press onslaught had started in 1991 when an insolent reporter from Forbes magazine, Rula Khalaf, coined me as a twisted version of Robin Hood who robs from the rich and gives to himself and his merry band of brokers. She deserved an A for cleverness, of course. And she's fictionalized in the movie where Leonardo DiCaprio plays the Wolf of Wall Street and she is portrayed by Sandra Nelson. Her name is changed. They call the reporter Alia Faran, but it's her.
That's when you know that you've done your job, when you end up in a movie. Who would you want to play you in a movie, Richard Dean?
Brad Pitt.
Malcolm Taylor?
I have no idea. I hadn't even thought of that. I have no idea.
I was discussing this weirdly with a group of authors over lunch yesterday because I was talking about having interviewed Nick Leeson about 12 years ago now, easily, the guy who brought down Barings Bank. And although he dislikes being referred to as that, unsurprisingly. And in the conversation that I had with Nick Leeson, the movie had just come out in which Ewan McGregor was playing him.
Yeah.
And I said to him, have you watched the movie? And he said, nah, 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 nah. And I thought, I reckon you have.
You would, wouldn't you?
Because you would.
You just would.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
You absolutely would.
What about you?
Well, and who would I want? Colouring, if not BMI, Nicole Kidman.
That's good.
Or two Nicole Kidmans sellotaped together in order to get the proportions right.
Nicole Kidman is good. Brad Pitt is good. Malcolm Taylor, we shall give
I know,
you.
I can handle two Nicole Kidmans sellotaped together. I'll take that as well, really.
You've got until the end of the show to decide who's going to play you in the movie of your
I'm
life.
I'm going for Anthony Hopkins.
That's not a bad call.
I reckon that Anthony Hopkins would do a good Malcolm Taylor.
Hang on, he's dead, isn't he?
No!
A young Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we're talking Anthony Hopkins in his prime, certainly, nothing else.
Precisely.
Let us know who you think should play Malcolm in the biopic of his life. 4001. Or use the Messenger app.
Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.